I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. It is 28 degrees as I'm recording this. There are 6 inches of snow on the ground outside, and my kid is just absolutely throwing herself into snow piles, which means it is definitely soup weather. So this week, we wanted to really dig into soup, making it, searching for it around the world, and figuring out which canned chicken stock we should use, because we do not judge around here if you don't make your own chicken stock.
All right, should we have a smell? You want to smell number one?
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not getting chicken.
No chicken, Erica?
It smells like warm deli meat.
Ooh.
Never a more attractive phrase has ever been uttered than warm deli meat. That is your humble, splendid table team. Me, Sally, Jenny, and Erica really putting in the work, doing a blind tasting of store-bought chicken stocks that we'll get to later. But first, we're going to spend some time with a true connoisseur of chicken soup, Jen Lewis. Jen's a terrific chef in Portland, Oregon, and she's the author of a new cookbook, The Chicken Soup Manifesto, Recipes from Around the World. Hey, Jen, it's great to talk with you.
Hey, how's it going, Francis?
I'm okay, thanks. So you just wrote a whole book about chicken soup, and I have to say I have like kind of a basic question about chicken soup. Like, I like chicken soup as much as the next person, but what's the deal with chicken soup? Like, I mean, like, why is it such a...
It's a thing.
Depending on how you look at it, a cliche or, like, you know, a stand-in. It's like a universal stand-in for warmth and home and healing. Like, why chicken soup?
It's true. It's totally true. Chicken soup is, well, in the States, we think of it typically as Eastern European Jewish chicken soup. Like, if you were to go to a deli for lunch and you got a cup of soup and it was chicken soup that day, you'd get, like, what you expect is brothy chicken noodle soup, or it might have rice in it, maybe some carrots, like kind of old school Eastern European.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know how it became so popular in the States, but every culture has one of those. And it's just because every culture typically eats chicken unless they are vegan or vegetarian. A lot of places have chickens running around in their yards. They're inexpensive. They're accessible. Mm. It's a universal food.
Yeah. But then, you know, the fact that you have found chicken soups, you know, from so many different cuisines, when you were doing your research, when you were talking to cooks from different cultures, like, were there common themes that people would talk about when they talk about, oh, the chicken soup they grew up with or the chicken soup they love to make?
Yes. There were two universal stories that chicken soup is for healing, first and foremost. And then the second one that came up over and over is that chicken soup is for hangovers. Those are the two. It's true. And people would talk about, like, you know, that they would always go out for this spicy chicken soup at the end of a big night of partying, or the next morning you'd have chicken soup. But it was really funny, the two things.
That's so interesting. What's the connection with healing?
You know, I thought a lot about this, and I grew up in a Jewish family, so chicken soup was the cure-all. It's our Jewish penicillin. And I believe that the collagen, all of the stuff that gets drawn out of the bones as you make a really delicious stock or soup, I think those are really good for you. I call it liquid gold. Like I tend to eat, you know, a fairly plant-based diet, but I always have chicken stock in my freezer to use. I just think that it's hydrating. It has a lot of value for our bodies.
That's so interesting. I actually definitely want to talk to you about stock later, because I in some ways I'm so tired of people talking about, oh, you got to make stock. But then there are things I really want to talk about, making stock. But let me ask you this too. So, you know, there are these themes around chicken soup that do seem universal to you and talking to so many cooks from around the world, but what are two of the most different chicken soups that you found?
Well, I'll start with South America, because all of South America uses really, for the rest of the world, very unique vegetables. And what that does, using carrots and yuca and corn, all of these really sweet root vegetables, makes the broth really sweet. And when I started making South American soups, I was really floored because it was so different. Sure. Like sancocho, which you see in several South American countries, and you also see in like Puerto Rico. And they're made a little bit differently, but they're typically chicken, sometimes other meat, but they have all of these really sweet and delicious vegetables in the broth. And so that is one style. And then you can look at the way other style of like Southeast Asian, where you've got really cool, either a clean broth or a coconut milk broth. Sometimes there's rice or rice noodles. And then, you know, you might see like, you know, coffee or lime leaves and lemongrass. And so it's a whole different world. And then you can even go to somewhere like Afghanistan, where their yakhni is very, very similar to Pakistan, where they have a yakhni as well, which I just think they're pretty much the same soup. I think from house to house, they might make it a little differently, but it's got, you know, turmeric and it's got cardamom and it's got cumin and these really warm, very like, it's really delicious flavors. And those three examples are so different.
Yeah. And then what are some that you found were surprisingly similar? I mean, like that you wouldn't have guessed these two things came from totally different cuisines.
Right. Well, I may not be answering your question, but I think this is kind of like that. And you can pester me after. But you'll see the same soup in different places in different ways, which I think is fascinating. And, you know, starting out writing a chicken soup book, I'm just like, ah, they're chicken soup. But all of a sudden you realize when you go to Brazil and you realize that they speak Portuguese there. And yeah. The chicken soup that they have there actually comes from or has heritage from the Portuguese chicken soup. They're just a little bit different. I'm like, of course. But you don't think about that to start. And all of a sudden you're like, oh, of course, that makes total sense. Or you go to like the Philippines where there's an island that's a Chinese seaport. And they have a soup there that's a clear broth with the Chinese influence of dumplings, like pork wontons in the soup. You've got the Spanish influence of fried shaved garlic. And then you have a fish sauce, which comes from the Filipino culture. And so you have all of these ingredients showcasing that. And so
all in the same soup.
Yeah. And it's amazing.
That sounds really good.
It is so good. It's totally good. It's very simple. It's really good. But it's really neat how you see how cultures influence each other. Sure. It's cool.
Yeah. And it's all in the bowl.
Yeah.
So let's talk about making soup. As you said, you know, soup shouldn't be hard. You don't have to overthink it. But are there things you definitely want people to keep in mind as they're making soup? Like, are there techniques that you're like, oh, you always have to do this, or at least always keep this in mind?
Well, I am the cook that says there's a lot of ways to get to the end point. And I, working in restaurants and working with a lot of other chefs, like there's some people who are like, this is the way you do it. You always do it this way. This is how it works. But you know, I have very minimal training. So I think that when I, you know, became a chef, I just kind of collected what worked for me. Mm-hmm. And so I really think there's a lot of ways to do it. I mean, who's to tell a little old awesome grandma in, you know, rural Indonesia that she's got to sear the meat first? Maybe she just throws it into the pot. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not gonna have that fight with her. So it's there's a lot of ways to get to the end result. I think that there's a few things that are important, like, you know, to boil your stock or to simmer your stock. That's a really interesting question. You know, you look at something like a really rich ramen that is boiled, and what happens is the fat from the skin or from the fat in the meat, it starts to emulsify into the stock, giving it kind of a greasy mouthfeel. Mm-hmm. And that's really good in certain applications. In other applications, you want something cleaner. And I'd say for making chicken soup, you want a cleaner mouthfeel for most soups, but not all. I think more Asian cultures tend to see a richer and fattier mouthfeel, and more Western cultures tend to have a cleaner broth. And I do that by bringing my stock to a boil and then turning it really low and letting it simmer with, you know, I call it a lazy simmer. So you see some action, but it's very gentle, mm-hmm. and you keep it gentle. Otherwise, you know, you'll get a more greasy mouthfeel on your stock.
Yeah. Okay. So when I went to culinary school, that was how I was taught to make stock. And sort of to your point before, I was taught it in the context of this is the right way to do it, mm-hmm. right? So I was mm-hmm. like, oh, okay. Like
I want to be right.
Yeah, I want to be right. You know, like I want to get good grades. You know, totally. I'm a pleaser. I want, you know, the teacher to be happy with me, whatever. So like in my head, I was like, okay, right way, wrong way, you know?
Right.
And so I have always thought you barely get it hot. You're almost just steeping it for literally, you know, I remember exactly. For chicken bones, it should be 3 to 4 hours. For pork bones, 8 hours. And like beef and veal bones is 12 hours. Like, you know, there were specific times.
Good job.
And well, let me tell you, I have not put that knowledge to use in a long time because at some point I was just like, screw it. No one's great in this. But I do still think of the low simmer as being like, quote unquote, the right way. And right. it does have a particular use, like you say. Like if you want to make something that's really clear where the fat kind of rises to the top and you can skim it off.
Because that's good, because then you can use that schmaltz. Mm.
Oh, see, that's great. Because in school, it's like, oh, that's just impurities, garbage. Right? We always talk about being impurities.
Know.
And we like throw it out because it was impure. I'm like, I don't know what weird Puritan vibe that is, but like that's what we called it, right? And then at some point,
it's also called the scum, just so we have it complete.
Yeah.
I'm like, cool, maybe.
Yeah. But then the thing that kind of like turned my head around was, actually, I love the example you brought of, you know, of ramen. And there's a tradition of tonkotsu, which is mm-hmm. like a hard-boiled pork bone broth, traditionally pork. And the whole idea is you want all of the protein, you want all of the collagen, you want all that fat to emulsify. And it gets milky thick. And it's, hey, guess what? Really delicious.
It's so delicious.
So there's no such thing as right way, wrong way. It's
what you want.
Do you want it fattier, richer, milkier? Do you want it clearer, more crystal? And you can adjust, you know, in between the two. And so in your exploration, I mean, did you find soups that surprised you and how like, oh, this didn't start with a clear chicken broth. This starts with a cloudier, fattier one.
Not a ton, but I did find, and it's really interesting, two things. One is those silky black chickens. They're Chinese.
Mm. Like a type of chicken called the silky black. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's got black skin, darker meat, and it's much leaner. So it's not as rich as what Americans are traditionally getting from the grocery store. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they say to boil it for like X amount of minutes. And I'm like, I've never really thought about boiling. And you do. It's just a different texture culturally. Mm-hmm. And they're really amazing to work with. They're just really different. And then also like things like, you know, as far as boiling, when you add a starch like rice or noodles, that will cloud your broth. Sometimes with noodles, it's nice to cook them on the side and add them when you eat your soup for two reasons. One, it'll cloud your broth and, you know, whether you care or not. And then two, they tend to keep absorb. I don't know. It's like magic. The soup, the noodles continue to absorb the soup. So like you put it in your fridge and then all of a sudden you've got like a container full of fat noodles and no more broth. So sometimes if you're going to keep it for a couple of days, adding the noodles as you eat it.
That's Jen Lewis. Her latest book is The Chicken Soup Manifesto, and we'll be back with more with her in a minute. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lam, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. So hey, we're spending this episode with Jen Lewis. She's a great chef. She's the author of The Chicken Soup Manifesto, and we're going to be taking your cooking questions with her next. But if you have questions for us for a future show, record them as a voice memo on your phone and email them in. contact@splendidtable.org. Now let's get back to Jen. Let's talk about vegetable stock or vegetable broth too. Do you have a way you like to make it? Do you have a particular recipe you use? Or are you like let's just improv this and get some vegetables in a pot with some water?
Well, I think I make stock a little bit differently than a lot of people. I don't use any vegetables in my meat stocks unless I'm doing like, you know, like a demi or something. Then I'll, you know, I'll use my tomato product, my wine, etc. But I tend to, when I'm making just chicken stock, bones with, you know, with meat on them or whatever, with water up to the top of the bones, and I let it go for like 6 or 7 hours, and I like a really clean stock. And I can use it for anything. I can adapt it to whatever flavors I want it. With vegetable broth, you know, I've been getting these really cool produce boxes that just ended, boo. And they have beautiful fennel with the tops. And so I don't tend to eat a lot of the tops. And so I always make stock with it. And this past time I did that. I have a bit of black garlic, oddly, and I've been throwing some black garlic in there, which gives it some nice flavor. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, a few vegetables that give some nice flavor. But, you know, I don't think it has to be anything set. I think some onion or some leek tops are really nice. You know, if you want to go the rich route that you're making, like, gravy, then I'll make like a really cool mushroom broth that I keep cooking down mushrooms and adding a bunch of wine. But that's for something specific. But typically, if I'm just making a vegetable stock, I don't use lots of starchy vegetables.
Yeah. And do you have are you like a simmer 20 minutes kind of person, or do you let it go for longer than that?
I don't time it. It's done. It's done when it's done. I'd say maybe 30 minutes or so. And then I just let it sit and steep for a while and then strain it. But it's nice. And I'll put some, like, I'm really lucky. I have a lot of really cool herbs in my garden. So I go out and I pick some rosemary and some fresh bay, and I'll put that in depending upon what I'm using the stock for. But it's nice to have those flavors.
Yeah. That sounds great. Yeah, I mean, I'm totally with you. I rarely make stock anymore, to be completely honest. I'm pretty lazy about it.
What do you use?
Honestly, like, kind of whatever.
I
save all my liquid from cooking beans because I think that it's a flavorful, delicious liquid, and it's usually neutral enough that I can kind of go whenever I need it to go in. Because I also think about, okay, what does stock get you? Besides the particular flavor of, say, chicken or, you know, whatever meat or bones you're using. It's like, basically, it's just there to kind of add a little more. It's kind of filling in the space of the flavors, right?
It's like a conduit.
Yeah, you know? And so for me, it's like, a lot of times, it's just a little bit of umami. So, like, I might just use water and just shake a couple drops of soy sauce or a couple drops of fish sauce into it.
Yeah, yeah.
Just to get a little umami in the water and then call it a
day.
And whatever else is in the dish is going to end up being the flavor. Again, it's great to have a great stock, but I'm just a little lazy about it.
Well, you got to hack it at home sometimes. Like, you're busy, you're doing stuff. Like, you don't have time to sit and you know, make stock and throw it in the fridge or freezer and all that. So you have to make it doable.
Yeah, and I have like pretty limited freezer space. That's also one of my deals. Anyway, okay. Speaking of freezer, I want to get us over to some listener questions. We actually have a whole bunch of listener questions.
Excellent.
And the first of them actually has to do with the freezer. Let's go to Stacy.
Hi, Francis and guests. I have been listening to Splendid Table for a long time. My name is Stacy. I live in Tulsa, and I finally have a question. I go shopping at this new store, and they have these frozen bones. They're neck bones, they're lamb shanks, and oxtails. Mm. And I'm like, great, this is good for my dog. What else can I do with them?
Happy
I think
dog.
You're supposed to cook with them and not just give them to your dog, so I'm not entirely sure. I would love to know how you cook with them.
All right.
Well, that's a great question.
Yeah,
those are some of my favorite things. I know, we can. Well, Stacy, this is one of the best times of year to work with a lot of those. Those are great for braising. Mm-hmm. And what braising means is to cook a piece of meat or cook something in a flavorful liquid. And that usually is like something like stock. It might have wine in it. But it's something that will cook what we call in the industry low and slow. So you cook this piece of meat very gently, and you kind of ease all of that delicious texture out of it, and all that flavor kind of just does its magic. So I would say look for some braising recipes for these cuts. And oxtail is really cool because once you cook it, you can pick it and use it in a pasta sauce. You could stuff it. I made some roasted eggplant recently. I cut it in half. I roasted it. I scooped out the inside, and then I chopped that up, and I added in some lamb. And so you can certainly do that with all of these different pieces. At my restaurant, Lincoln, that I used to have, I actually used to...
God, I love that restaurant.
You're so nice. I used to serve whole oxtail sometimes for two, and I would serve it on this huge platter. I know. I was so weird.
Wait, like it was all so like seven joints of it or whatever?
Oh, yeah, totally. I would braise the whole thing. It was super cool.
Incredible.
And I'd serve it with flatbread that was nice and warm. I'd serve it with three different sauces and maybe some kind of side vegetable of, you know, whatever seasonal and really tasty. And people like could pick the meat off at the table and eat it on flatbread and eat these different sauces and some vegetable. And that is so fun. And this is a really great time of life because we're hanging out at home. That's a good time to braise because it smells good and to have a wacky dinner like that. So... Stacey, I think that's what you should do.
Oh, man, I love that. I wish I could have seen what a whole oxtail looks like. I can't even imagine.
It totally looks like a tail.
Well, I'm going to say this, and I'm totally with you. I'm glad you said, you know, we could sit here and think of like, oh, what we might put in a braise that, you know, a neck bone braise or an oxtail braise. But I think you're right. Like, go and look at pretty much any recipe you find for any kind of braised meat, a pot roast, a braised short rib, whatever. If you like the flavors that are being, you know, featured there, go ahead and use that recipe, but use this cut. And I think what's beautiful about, it's funny, it's like the two extremes of the animal, right? The tail or the neck. But what's really notable about them is that they are bony and... I think sort of in a beautiful and strange way, the bones like have lots of nooks and crannies. And so the meat is in lots of nooks and crannies. So it's not going to be the kind of meat that you're going to take and necessarily like go out with a fork and knife. There's a lot of connective tissue, a lot of tendon that will really just with enough time and enough heat and enough liquid will actually literally melt. And so that makes the broth super rich and it makes the meat super tender. But I guess what I'm getting is when you're done cooking it, you have to get in there with your hands, you know, and you're just plucking little bites out of it all over the place. And
totally agree. And that's fun. Like,
yeah,
you know, I think also that thing of when you braise something, you may use some of the liquid for a sauce. Great. The rest of that liquid that you've braised in is gold.
Oh,
you can
incredible.
Make delicious soup with it. You could do so many things with that broth.
Oh, that's totally gold. It's totally gold. All right, let's move on to a call from Kathy.
Hello, I'm from Minneapolis. I'm wondering how to use powdered sumac. Do I add it at the end of cooking, at the beginning of cooking? Is it to be sautéed like maybe Indian spices are kind of a sautéed first before they're added? I'm not sure how to use it, and I would appreciate knowing. Thank you very much.
That's a great question, Kathy. I don't think a lot of Americans tend to use sumac. And sumac's a really unique spice. It's actually a berry, and it's ground. And it has more of a tart flavor, like lemon, but it's not acidic. And so I like to use it in things like salads. You know, you could put it in your salad dressing or sprinkle it over before you toss it. I think it's really nice, like, to maybe take some soft butter and maybe whip it with some sumac and maybe some fennel that's ground.
Oh, cool.
And maybe, like, cook some fish with that. And so you want to think of, like, you know, dishes that you may want some brightness to without necessarily the sour. It's got a real good tangy flavor. Traditionally in the Middle East, you'll tend to see something like labneh, which is like a strained yogurt, you'll see some sumac sprinkled over and you can kind of dip some bread in it. It's just a really nice way to wake something up, vegetables. You don't need to saute it like you do or toast spices. Usually it's pretty good on its own. What do you do, Francis?
I just listen to you.
Awesome.
I mean, I don't use a lot of sumac at home, to be honest. I like it. I just actually don't think I even have any right now. But I think of it almost like to your point, it's almost like a dry lemon. Mm-hmm. So if you want something where you don't want to add like lemon juice, where like the liquid gets in the way, but you want to add the brightness that you would think of adding a squeeze of lemon, or God, I can imagine it so many ways. That'd be so cool. I can imagine it on like fries, you know, instead of like vinegar and fries, which gets it soggy, like you can dust some sumac on the fries and you get that cool acidic sort of bright tartness to go with your fries, or, you know, fried fish or anything like that. And
yeah, like mix it with some salt and use it as a seasoning salt.
Yeah. All right, let us go now to Janet.
My name is Janet. I'm from Pullman, Washington. And my question is, how do grandmas and great grandmas from Italy make wonderful pasta without the attachments on a KitchenAid mixer? I have made pasta two or three different times now, and I can get the flavor great, but I have no attachment, and I can't get the consistency right. My last batch of pasta, I cut it up into really small little chunks and threw it into some chicken soup, and it made a wonderful gnocchi style.
There we go.
Little bit in my soup, but it definitely was not the pasta I was aiming for. So please help. Thank you.
Oh, Janet, those grandmas, they're amazing. They work magic. That's why. They do. Like when you see women, grandmothers who've been making pasta in Italy their whole lives, they're incredible. I can't do anything like, they take this like little tiny rod and roll out the thinnest sheet of pasta that I've ever seen. And it's mind blowing. They're pros. That's why.
Yeah.
But I'd say, you know, you don't have to have an attachment by any means. I do think they're really helpful. And if you make a lot of pasta, it's a good investment, or sometimes you can find them used online. But by hand, you can certainly make pasta dough. You just need to mix it with your hands and do a really good job kneading. And you don't want it too wet, and you want it to hold together. So a little on the drier side is just fine. But when you roll it out, you really just want to make sure it's thin. The most important thing is to let it rest after kneading it and rolling it. You want to let it rest because it's going to absorb liquid. So all that moisture is going to kind of slowly absorb into the flour. And then the gluten's going to be relaxed. You've just kind of agitated all the gluten, which is the protein and which gives it structure, and you've agitated it through kneading. But when you stop kneading, it needs a little time to relax so that you can easily roll it out. And then it'll be much easier. But I think to get those really thin sheets like the masters make,
Where you can like read newspaper through them.
Totally. Absolutely. Like I consider myself a pretty solid pasta maker, but nothing like that. Like I get blown away every time I go to Italy. So, maybe I'm not a solid, I have so much to learn.
Well, you know, you literally wrote a whole book about making pasta by hand.
Yeah, true.
But if this is like your kind of first go at making pasta by hand, is there a one you like to suggest to people to start with?
Yeah, you know, like, so I wrote a book about basically dumplings, like gnocchi. And those you definitely don't need a machine for. And it's called Pasta by Hand. And what I really like about that machine is it's very user-friendly, or not the machine, the book. What I really like about the book is that it's very user-friendly. And it showcases gnocchi and things that are like gnocchi but not gnocchi from all the different regions around Italy. And it's a nice little way to travel around Italy and understand where things come from and what the difference is. And so I'd recommend starting with that. And there's some hand-formed and there's some more rustic. And they're all things that you can easily do at home without a sheeter or attachment.
Right on. All right, let's go to Chip.
Hello, Jen, and everybody at the Splendid Table. Happy soup season to all of you. The question I have for today is about thickening soup, because there's nothing more lackluster than a pot of soup where all the solids are on the bottom, 4 inches of broth on the top. You have to stir it up to get a uniform scoop into each bowl. What are some thickeners that I might not be thinking about to kind of make a more well-incorporated soup where every scoop has a bit of everything in every bowl? What are the magical ingredients to make a nice thick soup? Thank you so much and enjoy the rest of the soup season.
That is a great question, Chip. I just dealt with that last week. I made some potato leek soup last week, and I didn't want to puree the whole thing. But when I looked into the pot, it was a whole bunch of potatoes and leeks on the bottom of the pot. So, right? And so what I did is I have an immersion blender that I use for a lot of stuff. And I took the immersion blender and I put it in my pot and kind of pulsed it. And it gave me just enough body to be able to have kind of some pieces and some rich, thick soup. And it was a really nice blend. I also think you can use things like a handful of rice the last like 10 minutes of making your soup. You could use a roux, which is some like butter or oil cooked or melted, and then you add some flour and cook that for a little while, and you can add soup to that, and that will help thicken. Some people use cornstarch, and you see that in a lot of Asian soups.
And
I think those are really good ways. I think some things you want to puree and some things you don't. So either pureeing or adding another ingredient like the rice, or adding a thickening agent like cornstarch.
Jen Lewis's latest book is The Chicken Soup Manifesto. We'll be back with her in just a minute, and then we put canned chicken stock to a taste test with some extremely unsparing judges. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're talking soup today with the chef Jen Lewis, and we are taking advantage of her vast array of cooking knowledge with your questions. Let's get back to her. Okay, we have another soup question. There's a lot of soup talk. Here, let's go to April.
Hello, my name is April, and if you're doing like a fish soup, can you add smoked salmon for flavor? I was just curious. Thank you very much. Bye.
Okay.
April, yes. That's all I'm going to say is April, yes. Add that smoked salmon because smoked salmon is delicious. But there's a couple different kinds of smoked salmon, right?
Yeah.
So you have some that's heat smoked or cold smoked, and some is flaky and some is almost like you'd put on your bagel. And so I think that the flaky stuff is that looks like you've cooked fish and kind of flakes. That stuff lends itself to a soup a little bit better than more of your salted and cured and smoked that way because of the textures. But yes, I think that it will be delicious in your soup. I would highly recommend it, and I'd like you to make me a bowl.
Yeah, if you're into it and you love that flavor and you're making a fish soup and you want to add a little smokiness, I would say do it, and maybe even just do it at the end where you just kind of maybe
yes,
even have it at the table
point.
And like put it on the bowl in the bowl. After like, you've served it.
You're right. Like a garnish that gets kind of mixed in.
Yeah.
But also like a chowder is a really nice place to flake some of that in. And if you're making your stock for something like that, I would recommend using some seaweed in your stock and some onions and some lemon.
Oh, cool.
I like to keep like some kombu in my, and I cook, you know, a bit of Asian, but I wouldn't say I'm super awesome, but I love just keeping a little bit of kombu for stuff like that. It's delicious.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. We talked about stock before, and then we talked about vegetable stock, and we didn't even bring up kombu and dashi, which, you know, dashi is sort of like the Japanese mother stock, and it's in so much of Japanese cooking. It's incredibly light, delicate, beautiful, can flavor so many things. And it's made of kombu, which you said is seaweed. It's
I
a
know.
Dried sheet of seaweed and like smoked fish flakes, bonito flakes. And that's it. And it's almost you make a tea. You basically make a tea with those things. It takes not much time at all. And but tell me about your fish soup. Like, I'm curious of like the process you use, because people think it's not a very sexy thing in most people's minds. They hear fish soup and they're like, I don't know, really? But it can be so delicious.
Oh, it's so pretty. It's such a beautiful soup. And it highlights, when you have a really delicate broth like that for soup, it really highlights fish. And I think that a lot of times fish is gets so many ingredients or so much spice over it that you just don't taste the fish anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's why I eat fish. And that's why I eat sushi, is for the fish itself. And so I really like that unburdened use of it. I have a recipe in my greens book that I learned in Newfoundland. And it's this, I make the broth with seaweed, and then it must be like a cod soup up there, but they take some salted cod, and you make like a broth with kombu, and it can also very, very easily be done with salmon, and you flake the salmon in at the end. But it's just nice. You just make a nice clean broth with some kombu and water. You know, and then you can go different ways. You could later add miso. You could include some lemon zest or maybe a little bit of orange. You could put a tiny bit of sesame oil in at the end. Mm. Garlic is nice. Some leeks are really nice. Fennel, just some really light complementary flavors. Maybe, and some black pepper, whole black peppercorns in there is great. Just a few.
Yeah. Yeah, and you just... And that's all it takes, right? And you just like simmer it a little bit if there's vegetables in it, until the vegetables are done, and then drop your fish in.
Oh, so good.
And the fish cooks like right away, and there you go.
Dinner's fast.
Yeah, dinner's fast. Hey, let me ask you one more thing before we go. And it just occurred to me because, you know, we're emailing to schedule this conversation, and you happen to email Sally, our producer, that you've been super busy starting up a food pantry.
Tell me about that. You know, it's I haven't been this excited about doing something in a really long time, and it's amazing. So, you know, we're going through a hard time all over the world right now, and
for sure.
I feel very fortunate to have a roof over my head, a soft bed to lay in, plenty of food, like all that kind of stuff. And I see more and more tent communities popping up in Portland, and the number of people who are homeless for lots of different reasons is just mind-blowing. Yeah. And I just got to a point where I know I'm on the board of a food pantry, and I volunteer there, and I, you know, volunteer at a family homeless shelter. But there's just too many people on the street, and their needs aren't getting met. And, you know, I have zero judgment for anyone on the street or why they're there or anything, but I care that they're getting their basic needs. Mm-hmm. And so I just started to make meals and put them in to-go containers and put them in a cooler. My boyfriend calls it a heater because it keeps it hot rather than cold for me. And I bring hot meals around. And then I was kind of thinking about posting it, or should I not? And I did. And I've had this overwhelming response. And people are reaching out to me on Instagram and Facebook and contributing. And like yesterday, I took a little extra loop, and I found four tents next to the freeway, and I pulled over, and I asked them if they wanted some hot meal, and I had some clean socks, and so I offered them some socks, and one of the guys said, "Do you have any jackets or sweaters?" I said, "You know, I don't." I said, "What do you need?" And that's my question that I ask everybody, what do you need?
Yeah.
And he told me, and I came home, and a friend of mine stopped by with a couple blankets, some coats, some hats, and some thicker socks. And I put a bag of like snacks together and just kind of some basic stuff and some soap and all that. And I brought it down to him yesterday. And, you know, I know that he was going to sleep more comfortably than he has. And it's a really amazing thing to do. Somebody gifted me a 27-pound turkey yesterday. So I'm making some stuff with it today.
For sure. Yeah. Awesome.
But I've gotten to know some people, and I've gotten to take care of some basic needs, and, It's a real good way to cook.
Yeah, that's so incredible.
Yeah, it's a total honor to be able to help somebody when they need something.
Yeah.
It's pretty great.
You're doing good stuff there, Jen Lewis. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Francis.
Jen Lewis's latest book is The Chicken Soup Manifesto, and from it, she left us her recipe for pancit molo, that Chinese-Spanish-Filipino bowl of amazingness she talked about. You can find it at splendidtable.org. Okay, so the quote-unquote proper way to make chicken stock was pounded into my head when I went to culinary school. But, you know, in real life, I pretty much never do it anymore. Like I talked about with Jen, you know, I find workarounds and substitutions, and for sure, I have zero problem with anyone cracking open a can of the stuff. Or these days, more often than not, cutting open a box. But yeah, they are not all made the same. I mean, I have opened some truly appalling packages of chicken stock in my kitchen. So we got our team together on Zoom. Me and our producers, Sally and Erica, and our technical director, Jenny, to taste a few of the most common supermarket brands. Now, Sally insisted that we do this blind, like a wine tasting. And so we all had our spouses pour them and like label them into unmarked bowls, heated them up, and made our bedroom recording studios all smell like a chicken sauna.
All right, team.
Okay.
I want to admit right at the very top that this is completely unfair because two of the stocks are regular, old, salted, you know, have salt in them. Mm-hmm. One of them is low sodium and one of them has no salt.
Okay.
But it's essentially what I could do in the pandemic, but they're all name brands. They're all mm-hmm. things that are easily found. Mm-hmm. So four stocks. Take a look at the color. Any thoughts on the color?
Three is pale.
Yes.
Really pale, right?
Really pale.
Yeah.
Kind of feels like I'm doing a drug test here.
I mean, one or two of these, I would be calling a doctor in a different context.
Yeah. Drink more water.
Maybe that's not an appropriate joke, but so, I mean, some of them are cloudier, some of them are clearer. This one definitely has like some stuff in it, which I don't know.
Which one? What number, Francis?
Number four. Definitely had some
number four
stuff. And then when I nuked it, because that's how I heat my things, classily, in a microwave.
Oh my gosh.
I think it was just fat. Maybe it was in fact chicken fat, which is, you know.
That's what my number four had chicken
sort
fat
of a
too,
good
which
sign.
Is probably a good thing.
All right.
All right. Should we have a smell? You want to smell number one?
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not getting chicken.
No chicken, Erica?
It smells like warm deli meat.
Ooh.
Never a more attractive phrase has ever been uttered than warm deli meat.
No.
It does smell meaty. It you know, it does smell sort of chicken soupy in that, I mean, that's tautological, but in that, like, you can sort of smell like a little bit of onion, a little bit of celery. You can smell some.
Where, homie?
I do this for a living, Erica. I learned a long time ago, if you don't smell it, just make it up.
And I'm wondering about rosemary. Do they put rosemary in for a preservative or something? Or just...
Oh, maybe.
As a flavoring, because...
It smells rosemary-ish.
I have to admit that I smelled them all ahead of time, and they all smell a little rosemary-ish, which I noticed right away because I'm not a fan of rosemary.
You cheater, Jenny. You're totally a cheater. Okay, let's move on to number two.
Sorry, rosemary.
Okay, number two, 100%.
Oh.
Smells like you opened a... smells like you put a chicken bouillon cube into water.
Mm-hmm. No, mine smells like wet dog. I'm sorry.
Oh,
it does.
I hear that.
Mine smells like instant ramen, which maybe says something about the flavor of instant ramen that I enjoy.
I wish mine did.
All right, let's move on to three.
Okay.
Smells like chicken, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sort of warm, watery.
It smells like warm.
It smells warm.
Warm,
you know?
Chicken dilute.
It smells warm.
Yeah.
All right, let's move to four.
Okay.
I got some on my nose.
Oh, the rosemary smell again.
Boy, I don't get the herbs.
This one's okay.
This one is opaque.
Yeah, it's super cloudy.
Yeah, number four is cloudy, but it smells the most like chicken.
Yeah, yeah.
Also with a deli meat kind of... overtone.
All right, on that note, let's start tasting, huh? Should we start with number one?
Okay.
Okay.
Here we go, number one.
Oh, better than I expected.
Yeah.
Flavorful.
It tastes like chicken soup. It tastes like the first step of chicken soup.
Mm-hmm.
It's not
good.
Bad.
All right, let's go to three then.
Oh.
Three.
Changing it up.
This is the one that smells like warm water.
But it doesn't taste
like
warm water.
It does not taste
like
warm.
No.
It smells a little bit like warm water, and it smells a little bit like... someone cooked rice in the next room over. And you're like, yeah. There's like a vague smell of something being cooked.
I can get that. Yep.
It tastes good, but I feel like it tastes better because it's saltier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely salt in this guy.
So those are obviously the two that have salt.
Okay.
So you guys have excellent palates.
Oh, excellent.
All right. So let's go to number two.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
I know this one.
Yeah,
I know
that
you.
That is really something else, isn't it?
I can't.
Kind of watery and a little bit stale.
I don't like that one.
I don't taste any chicken.
It does
chicken.
Not taste like chicken.
Nothing.
No, I don't either. No. Maybe a vegetable
was near it?
Walked by something? I don't know.
I think with this one, number two, I think I got what I have to say about it is it actually really tastes like chicken bouillon. Except, I mean, like there's some processed, dehydrated, powdered chicken flavor that is like all number two is. And it's actually weirding my brain out because there's no salt in it. Like you're used to the instant ramen being very salty. And because there's no salt in it, it's completely throwing my brain for a loop.
I think you're super generous. It tastes to me like the water after you've washed the pot that you've made the chicken soup in.
I haven't drank that water much lately, so I've just forgotten it.
Bland.
Yep. Yeah. Okay, last but not least, number four.
Four. Kind of like this one.
Four's legit, man.
Yeah.
Four is legit.
All right, so what would you pick, Jenny? What if you had to pick one and balance for the low sodium numbers, if you can? Which of the four would you pick? One, two, three, or four?
Well, I'm liking the salt. Hang on one sec.
Me too.
With number four, I would say there's a little bit of tin can flavor at the end.
I like three.
Which
you like three?
I like the salt. I'm a salt girl.
Okay, Erica.
I guess.
I like four, but I keep going back to one. Yeah, I think I like four.
Francis Lamb. What's your pick?
Okay, I don't know that I have a pick because I'm going to be completely honest here and say if I'm using, every chef of mine in culinary school and every chef I work for would have my head right now, but like I have definitely made some delicious soups and stews with packaged stock where I'm like, that doesn't taste good.
Yeah.
But it's all I got. Yeah,
you balance for it.
Yeah, and you can still make it taste good. Like salt, you add fish salt, you know, whatever. You can doctor most of this stuff. Nothing we tasted today feels irredeemable to me. And nothing here was actually gross. I guess number two is kind of gross, but like I'm just kind of.
Whatever. Oh my God, you're crazy.
I grew up eating instant ramen, so what can I do? Like it actually feels like, oh yeah, I know that flavor. We go way back.
He has a second career as a diplomat.
Right. So Francis, what's
number one?
Yes, what's your pick?
Number one tastes the most like chicken meat, like almost chicken breast meat. It doesn't have a very rich chicken flavor, but it has that sort of, you know, high note of chicken. And if you're not going to cook something for very long in this, it'll be just like a nice sort of chicken flavor to go alongside whatever else you put in it. And number four, I think tastes more like a chicken broth with bones and stuff that you've actually cooked for a while. There's a little bit of a deeper flavor.
So, so interesting. So number one is Kitchen Basics Original Chicken Stock.
Was that your favorite, Erica?
I was between one and four.
Okay.
Yep. Number two is Pacific Foods Organic Chicken Stock.
Yeah, I knew it.
Rough. Number three is College Inn, 100% natural chicken broth. And number four is Swanson, low-sodium chicken broth.
Oh, that Swanson is my usual go-to.
Yeah, that really held up really well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there you have it, a very unscientific tasting.
Right on.
It was good.
Anyone going to go out right now and stock up? I'd stock up on that Swanson, I think.
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
Swanson and
collagen. I'm actually going to make some Swanson chicken.
Yeah, soup. It's totally good. All right, team. Thanks for doing the dirty work.
Cheers.
So there you have it. You can find the results of that highly unscientific tasting on our website. And I don't know, maybe I was in a good mood because the one I honestly hated in the past wasn't that bad, I guess. But the good ones definitely tasted more like actual food. And look, real talk, I wouldn't make like consomme out of any of them, but unless one is completely unpalatable to you or too salty, which is really why I recommend you get the low sodium versions, you'll probably be able to make dinner with it. Like a good dinner, load it up with good vegetables and other flavors, make some soup, and just feel a little better about things. That's our show for the week. Remember, if you have cooking questions for us, send them in, record them as voice memos on your phone, and email them to contact@splendidtable.org. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. Keep your people safe. We'll talk to you next week. Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also subscribe to our weekly email, Weeknight Kitchen. Sign up at splendidtable.org. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.